anybody who flies over that and sees the devastation out there in the Gulf, who doesn't get angry at what has happened, has no emotion.
Senators debate the oil spill liability cap. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 25th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, what the dry weather means for Alaska's unofficial state bird.
For example, mosquitoes don't like this type of weather because they need the water for breeding.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
As the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico continues to flow and soil Louisiana's coastline, Washington is asking how oil company BP should be held accountable and what should be done in future accidents. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski has introduced a bill to make sure BP follows through on its pledge to pay claims from the Deepwater Horizon accident. It would waive the liability cap. Democrats have proposed their own solutions, but so far none on either side have gained enough momentum to move forward. There's been a lot of talk of just how much money in liability costs companies like BP should pay. One proposal would dramatically raise the cap from $75 million to $10 billion. When Murkowski expressed criticism recently and said the number seems arbitrary, the backlash was intense. The senator says she does think the ceiling should be raised. She just wants to do it with intention.
If Congress decides to impose a strict and direct liability of an additional $10 billion on top of the unlimited cleanup and the unlimited lawsuits that can be brought about against responsible parties in state courts, I think we have to consider what the potential consequences might be. Will there be jobs lost, particularly in the Gulf Coast?
Murkowski called for a hearing held Tuesday to discuss the liability limits. She says while they figure out what to do in the future, BP should indeed be on the hook now, as the Obama administration has also said. The company has pledged repeatedly to pay all reasonable claims.
There has been some mischaracterization out there that BP is only going to be responsible for $75 million of the spill. Ms. Chairman, if I really thought that the federal government was going to protect companies that have billions of dollars in assets and then require that they only pay $75 million regardless of the ultimate costs and damages for the spill, with taxpayers and spill victims that could possibly then be hung out to dry, I would be the absolute first to introduce legislation to correct what would clearly be a flawed system.
The Obama administration says it's focused on future disasters and wants to get rid of any liability cap so that companies would have to fully pay. However, White House lawyers say they don't see a need to make it retroactive since BP has already pledged the money. That drew an irate response from Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders.
What BP has said doesn't mean much. You may be the last person in America who trusts or believe what BP says. It doesn't matter. A year from now, the TV cameras will not be there. And some fisherman is going to have to go to court to try to get damages from BP, a multi-billion-dollar corporation. This guy doesn't stand the chance. Now is the moment. Do we lift the cap or do we not?
New Jersey Democratic Senator Robert Menendez is leading the charge to raise or throw out the liability cap. He asked Obama administration attorney Tom Perrelli about whether BP had made more than verbal promises.
Have they give you any written assurances that, in fact, they will be liable for above the $75 million cap?
I believe they've provided the written assurances that they provided to the cabinet secretary, Secretary Napolitano, and Secretary Salazar, and as you know, at least the chairman I know made such statements to some congressional committees.
I'd like to see if the department has a copy, or if not, Mr. Hayes, I'd like to see what was written. What's the nature of the language of BP's commitment? Because Exxon said all of these, many of these same things during the Exxon Valdez, and then they litigated all the way to the Supreme Court. took 20 years, and individuals fell off along the way who were damaged simply because they could not sustain it.
Senator Murkowski maintains there should be different liability requirements for companies doing deep water drilling versus shallow drilling, like in Alaska, and for big or small companies. But she talked to reporters Tuesday afternoon about a trip she took to the Gulf Coast and says she understands the strong criticisms being lobbed at BP.
We flew over this spill yesterday. Anybody who flies over that and sees the devastation out there in the Gulf, who doesn't get angry at what has happened, has no emotion.
Murkowski went on to say if she felt like BP was backpedaling in terms of responsibility, she might sound harsher toward the company. But she says it's been clear about its intentions to pay. Despite that, only moments later, Murkowski introduced her legislation to make sure BP makes good on its promise. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company reported a spill during a power failure at Pump Station 9 this morning. The power failure resulted in the tank relief valves opening. Subsequently, tank 190 overflowed and crude oil was released to secondary containment. This occurred as Alyeska was conducting fire command and valve leak testing at the pump station located near Delta Junction during a planned pipeline shutdown. Alyeska estimates that the potential spill volume to containment is up to several thousand barrels. The containment area has a capacity of 104,000 barrels. There were no injuries and personnel have been evacuated. Pipeline is currently shut down. An incident management team has been activated to manage the situation. Additional spill response crews and equipment are en route. Earlier this month, TransCanada Alaska President Tony Palmer told the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce that industry interest in his company's natural gas pipeline plan has been high in the first week of their open season. TransCanada is allied with ExxonMobil in seeking bids for the pipeline over the next 90 days. A second venture formed by ConocoPhillips and BP will also be seeking bids starting in July. These two open seasons for the largest construction project in the world are taking place under the rules set by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And they are being watched over by Larry Pursley, who is charged by federal law with the job of facilitating the process. Based largely in Washington, D.C., but with an office in Anchorage as well, Pursley had a press briefing today and appeared on the statewide show Talk of Alaska. He says the public will probably not know much of anything about the gas pipeline negotiations until late this year. FERC keeps it all confidential, guarding against an unfair advantage for any of the competing producers.
I liken it to that when we were younger and the astronauts would go to the moon, and when they hit the backside of the moon, there's no radio contact till they come back out and they call in and say, we're heading home and all is well. Same thing, the open season is where the two projects, one being TransCanada Exxon, the other being the Denali, which is BP and Conoco, they go out there and say, here's what we think we're going to build. Here's what we propose to build. Here's how much we think it's going to cost. Who wants to use our pipeline? And then those bids that they come in to the two project developers are not public.
It is a huge gamble involving $30 to $40 billion worth of financing. There is guesswork involved at every stage of the process. The interest rate, for instance, will depend in part on the risk. That risk would be driven down by federal loan guarantees, but they are currently not big enough to cover the entire cost of the project. There will likely be a move in Congress to increase them. A bigger gamble involves the market price of the gas.
If you knew somehow, some magical powers, that gas was never going to exceed today's price at lower 48 spot markets of $4, you wouldn't build this project. That won't be enough to cover the cost of producing the gas, getting it out of the ground, putting it in a pipe, and delivering it to Chicago, Milwaukee, Spokane, Des Moines, wherever it's going to go.
Tony Palmer says gas prices would have to double before they would support the cost of getting the gas to market from Alaska. There are also uncertainties in the markets for competing fossil fuels like oil and coal. And with recent disasters in both coal mining and deepwater offshore oil drilling, plus climate warming and the prospect of carbon limits, Pursley says the political climate is potentially favorable for Alaska natural gas.
You look at the options out there, a lot of people are not very happy with a future tied to coal. You can try cleaning it, but coal is still a lot dirtier than natural gas. you know, you spill gas, and unless you light it on fire, there's not a whole lot of damage. You spill oil, and as we're finding, it's particularly offshore, so that the public's looking at that. And I think it could work out very well for the Alaska Gas Project.
Pursley sees less promising markets for liquefied natural gas. He says Pacific Rim markets, whether Asian or West Coast, are not large enough to support the cost of an all-Alaska pipeline. Others vigorously disagree with that assessment, and the Trans-Canada open season does allow bids for an in-state line to Valdez. The other open season proposal will involve 4 to 6 points where the gas could be drawn off for Alaska use. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, trash and treasures intermingle at an unusual garage sale.
This is an accumulation of 20 plus years with two kids and a life in the military.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by the University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu.
Another gas line proposal is being floated in the state, but it's not aimed at getting North Slope gas to markets. This latest proposal would run from Cook Inlet across a portion of the Iditarod Trail and onto the proposed Donlin Creek gold mine near the Kuskokwim River. KYUK's Shane Iverson reports.
Building a mine is not easy, even if you're sitting on top of a 30 million ounce gold reserve.
We had intended to be into the permitting process at this time.
Doug Nicholson is Donlin's project manager. Donlin now sits idle. The permitting process has been pushed back several times in several years. All serious exploration wrapped up 2 summers back. There's no question there is a lot of gold in those hills, but how to get it out is another question.
So what we want to focus on is supplying the mine with power.
The plan is to make the proposed Donlin Creek mine one of the most productive in the world. Developers Barrick Gold and Nova Gold hope to produce 1 million ounces of gold each year. That will take a lot of energy, about 120 megawatts. To power that with diesel fuel, the mine estimates it would need to barge about 80 million gallons each year up the Kuskokwim River, and they would need a wind farm, none of which is cheap. Using diesel and wind, it would cost a bit under $400 to produce each ounce of gold. Considering that gold is selling for around $1,200 an ounce, that's still a moneymaker, says Professor John Tilton from the Economics Department at the Colorado School of Mines.
So even if you assume capital costs are a comparable amount per ounce of gold, this still would look like an attractive investment.
So long as gold prices stay very high, which they are right now and have been since about 2002.
I'm not sure whether it's the highest price or whether it's just one of the highest prices we've experienced. But even in real terms, adjusting for inflation, the price of gold today is quite high.
But gold prices can trend up or down. Now Donlin will spend about $20 million this year alone studying the geology between Cook Inlet and their site.
Energy is an important component of your cash costs. So if there was the possibility of a significantly cheaper source of energy, the $20 million would probably be worth investing.
Donlin says if they do use natural gas, they'll construct a 330-mile line with their own money. The proposal calls for a buried 12-inch diameter pipe that would start at Cook Inlet and would connect with the Iditarod Trail for about 70 miles to get through Rainy Pass. Mary Sattler is the community liaison for Donlin Creek.
It's an established route, and it's a passable route. I mean, that mountain range is very difficult to get through, and I'm sure that that's why the Iditarod Trail was established, because it's a route that's navigable.
Donlin has briefed the Iditarod Race Organization about their proposal. The Iditarod says they'll keep an eye on the project, but they say it's very early in that process. Developers have floated several other plans in hopes of avoiding the expensive delivery of diesel. That has included digging up nearby peat, building a coal plant in Bethel, or tying into the Healy coal plant. All of those plans have been scrapped. And even if a gas line proves more successful, they'll still be relying on a long haul up the shallow Kuskokwim River. Again, Donlin's community liaison, Mary Sattler.
Some of the larger equipment, there's just no way to really practically fly it in.
Donlin estimates the barge traffic on the river would be cut by about a third under the gas line plan. An airstrip on site would fly in some materials. Others would still come up the river. Donlin will be revising their feasibility study after exploring the gas line route. They hope to begin permitting for the mine sometime after July. At least that's the plan for now. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service today released the final decision on a proposed land exchange in the Yukon Flats National Wildlife Refuge with Interior Native Corporation Doyon Limited. The agency went with its preferred alternative, which means the exchange will not happen. Doyon Vice President for Lands and Natural Resources, Jim Murie, says company officials have known for some time that this was going to be the federal decision, although Murie says Doyon officials felt the exchange had viable benefits for both parties. They're not upset that the exchange did not go through. The U.S. Geological Survey found prospects on Doyon land that look promising.
We like the work that the U.S. Geological Survey had done. It was quite intriguing, and so we decided to gather 96 miles of seismic information up at Stevens Village this past winter. We work very closely with both the tribe and the village corporation, and we're currently just getting the information and processing it, and we'll be analyzing it over the next few months.
Murie says the long-term projected price of oil means smaller exploration projects may still be profitable. Doyon's original proposal would have exchanged 150,000 acres of its land holdings within the refuge for 110,000 acres of refuge lands that had potential for oil and gas development, with oil and gas rights to an adjacent 97,000 acres.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Center for Distance Education at University of Alaska Fairbanks, offering access to online courses from anywhere. Summer semester starts May 24th. Information at distance.uaf.edu. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This spring's dry weather is a mixed factor in the emergence of bugs. University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service Technician Kathy Turner says insects respond differently to dry weather.
There's some insects that benefit from hot, dry weather and others that don't. And, for example, mosquitoes don't like this type of weather because they need the water for breeding. And I know, like, for example, the leaf miners, they like dry weather, so while we're not necessarily seeing leaf miner damage yet, we might see quite a bit of it a little bit later.
Interior residents are already dealing with another bug that likes the warm, dry weather, wasps or yellow jackets, who Turner says are at the start of their nesting season.
I've been seeing quite a few wasps. They're the queens flying around. They're scoping out places to start nests. They're a little bit bigger than your average worker, and they're getting into homes and vehicles, things like that.
A large outbreak of yellow jacket wasps in 2006 resulted in two sting-related deaths in Fairbanks. Sea Alaska's earnings rebounded last year. The Southeast Alaska Regional Native Corporation's newly released annual report shows it made some money after a year of significant losses, but it's not fully over the economic hump. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld filed this in-depth report.
Sea Alaska lost about $40 million in 2008. That's mostly because of the dropping value of its investments. The recession still hurt operations in 2009, but overall, the corporation was back in the black with about $20 million in profits. That still puts it among the three worst years in a decade.
It was a hard year for us, but, you know, we're looking forward to a better performance. I have confidence that the economy is improving.
Sea Alaska Board Vice Chairwoman Rosita Worrell says some of its dozen and a half businesses are starting to pick up.
We had one plant, you know, where our employees were working on a half-time basis, but fortunately, because we've been able to secure additional contracts in those places, our people are moving back into full-time employment.
Sea Alaska just released a report detailing its 2009 performance. It's part of a package provided to nearly 21,000 shareholders in preparation for the corporate annual meeting. That will take place June 26th in Craig. The report shows natural resource operations doing less business and losing money in 2009 after a profitable 2008. Executive Vice President Rick Harris says timber and gravel did okay, but one new business called Wood Product Solutions did not. The California company marketed furniture, flooring, and other products made from sustainable timber. It's since been shut down.
We still believe that there's a great market for sustainable wood products. But it's going to take a while for the companies that buy that kind of material to work their way through the recession.
Sea Alaska's service industries, including government contracting and environmental cleanup, increased business by about 30%, but they lost money after a previous profitable year. Manufacturing, including plastics, metal, and construction operations, was profitable, but it made less and did less business than the previous year. The corporation also boosted its coffers with payments from a shared pool of resource earnings from other native corporations known as 7i payments.
All of them together helped contribute to that net income, some by being able to come out of the recession with small profits and not to be a drain on our net income. But the strong showing in 2009 was really from our investment portfolio.
If you pulled out investment income and if you pulled out 7i revenues, where would the corporation be?
Richard Reinhart Jr. is Sea Alaska's former chief financial officer and controller. He's also an independent candidate running for a seat on Sea Alaska's board of directors. He says more than the economy is to blame for Sea Alaska's weak business performance, he says many operations are top heavy.
The reason for the overhead was because, okay, if we're going to grow to that size, we're going to need to put more infrastructure in place to handle it. Well, the overhead's there, but the revenues haven't followed, and something needs to be done to fix that picture.
Overall, Sea Alaska lists about a dozen and a half business operations. Most are in the lower 48, including Kansas and Alabama, and some operate in Mexico or overseas.
They're perhaps diversified a little too much, have their fingers in too many operations, and may need to streamline back those that are not performing so well.
Sea Alaska did close a high-tech prototype operation last year, but it's expanded elsewhere, taking over full ownership of two environmental companies that had been partnerships. As Sea Alaska expands in the lower 48, many shareholders are asking about developing more businesses close to home. Reinhart suggests moving into the transportation, nursing home, or heating oil business.
Those are different ways that Sea Alaska could invest its money more locally, you know, rather than putting the money in Mexico, rather than putting their money in Alabama and Iowa, start putting money back in Southeast Alaska. Secondary to that, put money in Seattle, Puget Sound, and Anchorage in the Mat-Su Valley, where there are a large number of shareholders.
Sea Alaska is expanding Southeast operations with a new division called Ha-On-E. It's looking into wood pellets, oyster farming, and berry picking. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
It's spring when an Alaskan's fancy turns to garage sales. And this past weekend, folks at the Matanuska Susitna Borough Waste Transfer Facility came up with a new twist on a traditional Saturday morning activity. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
You've all heard the phrase dump diving. Well, there's a whole new way of salvaging usable items from the jaws of the landfill. The Matanuska Susitna Borough's scenic waste transfer site in Wasilla saw more action than usual Saturday. Environmental technician Terry Berger.
So we came up with a great idea, you know, especially during our spring cleaning campaign, is to get people here, make a little money, and then what they don't sell, they throw away. You know, a lot of stuff is fantastic.
That's right. Why just toss it? When for the few dollars it costs for a spot at the dumpside garage sale, a person can make a little bit of money on refuse. Remember, one person's trash is another's treasure. and what treasures there were on display.
Everyday things, a lot of DVDs, CDs.
This is the collection of yours?
It is. It's the beginning of trying to downsize the house and get things cleaned out.
Did this event give you the incentive to, like, clean out those closets?
Extra. Well, we were going to do garage sales anyway. We figured we'll collaborate and do it this way.
Now, is everything going to go into the dump that you don't sell?
I think I'm going to try to do a few garage sales this year and donate the rest.
Well, I have been collecting all my life, and my wife says it's time now to get rid of all my collectibles, so I'm trying to keep peace in the family here.
You're not going to put these in the dump, are you?
Oh, no. I'll take a lot of the good, most of the good stuff home.
Amid stacks of old books, pots, DVDs, off-road vehicle tires, hip waders, and a small ocean of plastic items defying description, there stood a line of delicate ladies' high-heeled shoes of varying sizes.
What does this represent to you? Is this the garage, the cellar?
This is cleaning out the storage unit. Spring cleaning. Time to get rid of some stuff.
Can you part with this? I mean, is it going to be hard to throw it into that dump after?
A lot of it will be hard to give up.
The do-it-yourselfers.
These are chicken waterers, these two here, and then these are chicken feeders.
What are you asking for this chicken waterer?
Make an offer. Make an offer.
I have to get a chicken first.
Like this one here is almost brand new, and even like for the wintertime, I've even got one of those magnetic battery heaters for a car that basically keeps the water flowing in the wintertime.
And the dreamers. Little Jenna's letting go of her Barbies and My Little Ponies.
Is this your Barbie guitar?
Yeah.
How can you sell it? How can you part with the hat?
Well, I can part with it because I'm getting older and I would like to sell it.
Yeah. So what are you going to do with the money you make?
Well, she wants to get a puppy.
Oh,
so she's saving up for a puppy, yeah.
A baby golden retriever.
For a real live puppy. Now that's recycling. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. Alaska's first pioneer home opened in Sitka in 1913. Continuing the tradition of loving care, five more pioneer homes opened over the years, including a veterans home in Palmer. If you are 65 years or older, need assisted living, and an Alaska resident for the past year, you can apply to live in a pioneer home. Information at 888-355-3117 or at the State of Alaska DHSS website. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.